then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's September the 4th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, the very first thing I want to do this week is something that I promised I would do last week, and that is that if someone would inform me where the interview that I broadcast with Dr. Henry Harpending came from, I would give due credit. Now, apparently, the Harpending interview is from a 2010 meeting of the H.L. Mencken Club in Baltimore. The interviewer is Craig Bodecker, whom I've never met, but whose name I am familiar with off Facebook. I'm also told that Dr. Harpending and another man, Dr. Gregory Cochran, are the authors of a book called The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution, which might be of interest to our folks. Now, on to this week's show. I know, this is considered cheating and phoning it in, but this is another week where I am really rushed off my feet on weekdays, and this time it's, of course, in a good way, preparing to welcome home some new migrants. But the fact is, I'm going to start off by laying another segment on you of myself on the Mike Harris Show back in July.
Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. Today is July 24th, Thursday. My guest today is Harold Covington. Harold, welcome back. And I forgot to unmute the microphone, and forgive me. Anyway, before the break, you were telling us this theory about the EBT cards. Would you please expand on that?
We were talking on my own show about an article by a man named Matt Bracken called When the Music Stops, and it discussed a, I think, very credible scenario as to how massive non-white rioting would break out in the country, all across the country, beginning in the urban areas when the EBT card system failed, and all of a sudden the MUYs, as Bracken called them, the militant urban youth, he mentions race a little, but he kind of backs away from it. Anyway, they start rioting because they become literally hungry. They can't get their ding-dongs and their purple drink and that sort of stuff. And the rioting starts with attacks on white commuters who are driving by, and then it spreads to the suburbs, so forth and so on. Now, that is one way that it could start. Now, remember, we were originally talking about the water situation in Detroit. I believe that the water will be turned back on in Detroit, if indeed it hasn't been already, because somebody probably has sense enough to realize that if these people get literally physically thirsty, they're going to go out into the streets and they're going to start attacking places that might have water, convenience stores owned by Koreans or whatever, and things could spread from there. The peace of this country, such as it is, depends on placating these huge masses of non-white minorities with bread and circuses, with food, with money, with entertainment, and so forth. And that is the way by which the system keeps these creatures penned in their urban areas. At some point in time, that system is going to break down, and they're going to break out of their urban areas and attack the white areas, the ring suburbs first, and then they're going to move across the countryside looking for white towns or whatnot, isolated homes to attack, because in their minds, white people have all the goodies. White people have all the nice stuff. White people have all the food. White people have these lovely young women that they can rape and violate in various ways. And I think somebody in the government in the power structure does have sufficient sense to understand the risks here, and so they are going to make an effort to prevent that from happening. I very strongly suspect that when the country does start to run out of money, the EBT system will be the last to go because they know they have to keep those direct deposits coming in.
Well, let us talk about that for a minute, because I have always speculated that one fact that people don't discuss often is that J.P. Morgan Chase controls the EBT system. If anybody uses an EBT card, whatever you buy, J.P. Morgan Chase is getting paid 2% to manage that transaction on every transaction. Very profitable for them. And if J.P. Morgan Chase wanted to start civil unrest within the U.S., they have at their fingertips everything they need to do right here, right now. It may not be a government issue. You have to remember that the banks use the government as a tool, but the banks are more powerful than the government, and the banks have been subverting the government for a very long time. So if the bankers at J.P. Morgan Chase, let's say Jamie Dimon actually gets indicted for something, if he didn't want to face charges and he can't talk Obama and Holder into letting him walk, they could unilaterally decide that, well, first of this month, there ain't going to be no new money in the EBT cards. It ain't going to happen.
Well, something like that, I'm sure, is why there have been no bankers or stockbrokers or any major financial figures indicted over the 2009 crash. Like this guy, John Corzine, I don't follow it all. I'm not that big on high finance, but apparently, either through just plain theft or incompetence, he literally pissed away billions of dollars. And almost everybody, even in the system, agrees that he broke the law, but he's still walking around sipping martinis and Trader Vic's at noon. Not one individual, except in Iceland, not one individual responsible for the crash of 2009 has been indicted or arrested or in any way personally inconvenienced.
Let's talk about that, because you're right. In addition to that set of offenses against people, 32 million American families were thrown out in the streets by the bankers. When the bankers have admitted committing open fraud, both in the origination of loans and in the foreclosure process, they have committed frauds. The bankers have been indicted and they've been prosecuted for laundering drug money. But in each and every case, they're allowed to pay some nominal fine. In the case of laundering drug money, I mean, for $500 million of laundered profit, they had to pay a $19 million fine. That's not justice. That's not a serious attempt at justice. And our people need to understand that the big money has corrupted our system through and through, that we no longer have a functional law enforcement. We no longer have a functional judiciary. We no longer have a functional Congress, Senate. All the court systems have been corrupted. And that the illusion that we're living in a free and just America is just that. It's an illusion. I recommend for people to often read a book by a man named Stephen Senge called The Fifth Discipline. And what people tend to do, and this is a business book, it's about determining what is your current reality. And it's not living with what you were used to a year ago or 5 years ago. It's what's going on today. And that's one of the biggest reasons businesses fail, because they think that, well, if we keep doing what we were doing a year ago, it'll correct itself because this has always worked in the past. And they ignore the current reality. And that's what the American people have been doing for a long time, is ignoring the current reality. And they've been relying on things because they're told to. They're misinformed via the mainstream media, whether it's Fox News or CNN or NBC or whatever. They're telling them that everything is okay. They cook the books. I mean, unemployment's not 6.1%. It's closer to 33 or 35%. But they change the metrics, and the real pretty girls on Fox News say, oh, unemployment's 6.1%. Everything's fine. Everybody wants a job can get one. And it's bull. It's complete bull. And until we have honesty out of our news media, we're not going to progress anywhere, anyway.
Yeah. Well, the real unemployment figure in this country could be gauged from the fact that there are something like right now 92 million adult Americans who are not working. And that is just insane. Also, if you look at it by demographic, the unemployment presently hits white males a hell of a lot more than any other group, especially white males over about the age of 40. Right now, if you're a white male and you're over 40 years old and you lose your job, there is a very good chance that you are never going to work again. I know.
Well, it's over 60% that you will never work again. And that's the sad reality of it, that if you're a white male over 40, if you lose your job, 60% of the time, only 4 of 10 of you will ever find new jobs. In those 4, you'll probably be working at about 60% of what you were making before you lost your job.
So it's a Walmart really, greeter.
Well, yeah, if you can get hired at Walmart, that's if you can get hired. The deck really is stacked against us. It just occurs to me that any time civil unrest suits the power structure, they have at their hands the trigger of the EBT card that they can turn off, and you're going to have the poor whites who are on EBT are probably going to suck it up and take it. But the blacks, the browns, are going to start burning. That's what they do when they get unhappy. They burn down their own neighborhood first.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when the EBT cards don't resume and the food and the purple drink run out, then they start moving out of their neighborhoods towards the white areas where there's still food and drink and running water and that sort of stuff. Well, it's just like the Diebold Corporation controls the voting machines in elections. We haven't had an actual honest election in this country in God knows how long.
Oh, I know. I know. And that's a tragedy. That's another part of the current reality. People have got to figure out that this electoral system that we've been depending on, that we have trusted to be honest, hasn't been honest for a very long time. And case in point is the appointment of George W. Bush as dictator of the United States instead of being elected president when the Supreme Court intervened and stopped the vote count in Florida. Now, I was not an Al Gore fan at all, and I've been a Republican. But George W. Bush is the reason, and his mismanagement of our country is the reason I'm no longer a Republican, because I cannot associate with people of that low moral character.
You know, in 2000, I despised Al Gore, of course. And when all this was happening, I thought at the time, well, yeah, that's kind of unconstitutional. We're supposed to elect a president, not have one appointed by the Supreme Court. But I figured, well, what the hell? Bush is just, he's the son of some Texas oil man, so we're going to have another 4 years of an empty suit running the White House at the behest of the big rich corporations. So what else is new? Boy, was I wrong. A lot of people, you know, like I now have a blog on the internet called The White Republican, which I'm using to sort of translate our message into terminology that normal white people can understand. A lot of people think from this that I've sold out and I've become a closet Republican or something. Believe me, no. The title of my personal blog, which I started back in those days, is downwithjugears.blogspot.com. So believe me, I remember. Republicans are no better than Democrats, and I certainly don't think that. The trouble is that for normal white people, the Republican Party, at least in the media, is the only legal opposition we are allowed to have. And so one of the things I'm trying to do, try and get our movement kind of out of the weird far reaches of cyberspace and back into real politics, is I'm trying to translate our message into a terminology or a coding, if you will, that normal white people can understand, because that's the same code that the system media uses, hence, you know, my use of the term Republican, etc. But no, I am by no means a Republican supporter. I have not forgot 8 years of George Bush and the lunacy that involved. The thing is that, in my mind at least, Barack Obama has managed to do something which I would have thought would have been impossible in 2008. He's actually managed to be a worse president and create a worse government than Bush did. But the seeds of our destruction were definitely laid during the Bush years. And, I think all the way back to the Clinton years.
Well, let me comment on that, because, you know, this has been, and I'll go back to the murder of JFK again. We have had the seeds of destruction laid one at a time. Policy after policy, you know, since then. I mean, the Immigration Reform Act of 65, the Civil Rights Movement, the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on terrorism, the free trade agreements, all of these things, the Reagan amnesty. My thing now is that we need to repeal the Reagan amnesty because it didn't deliver on its promise of ending illegal immigration. Therefore, what good did it do? The contract is null. The contract is void. I want my money back.
Back to the same problem, though. Let's say we do something like that. How are we going to enforce it? Really, Mike, how are we going to force millions upon millions of these people back south of the Rio Grande without massive military capability, which white people no longer have?
Harold, the point is to not go after the illegals directly, but to go after those who hire them. You know, Marriott Corporation, McDonald's,
that
anybody.
That was the solution all along.
It's always been the solution. And you know, we have laws on the books. It's $10,000 per person you hire who's illegally here. $10,000 fine. All right, Marriott, you've got 43,000 illegal employees who don't have authority to work in this country. Pay up. That's one approach. We also have laws on the books that you're not allowed to rent to people who are in this country illegally. So if you're renting to illegals, if you're Sam Zell with his equity apartments and you've got 18,000 units that are occupied by illegals, pay up, Sam. Let's see the cash. Come on. Show us the money. And if they have no place to work, if they have no place to live, they will self-deport. And one thing that people need to realize, I love the apologists for illegal immigration. I say, well, if you deported them all every day, you'd have buses lined up from the border of Mexico to the border of Canada. Well, yeah, you know, dumbass, they didn't get here overnight, and they're not going to go home overnight. But I look at Sky Harbor Airport in Arizona, 48 million people go through Sky Harbor Airport in a year. We have the logistical infrastructure to send them all home if we choose to. So far, the people want to do this, but the power structure does not. We had ongoing conflicts with the will of the people versus the will of the financial interest. And so how do we rectify this, and how do we get around it? What do we do?
The problem is one of political will. If we can move millions of troops to Iraq and Afghanistan over a period of 10 years, yeah, we could gradually. Assuming the political will existed now, yes, it would be possible to remove them. We would have to have a president with the political will to do this and ignore the screams on Salon Magazine or the Jon Stewart Show. We would have to have a solid Congress, both houses, that would cooperate with the president, basically do what the president wanted, pass the necessary legislation, and do it fast, not, you know, allow the Democrats to diddle around with it. The president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He would probably have to do a purge of the top echelons of the armed forces, getting rid of all the people that Obama has appointed, because Obama's been doing his own purge of the generals, I've noticed, over the past few years. And he'd have to ensure a solid armed forces that were behind him in this. Then there would have to be a nationwide law enforcement crackdown on anyone who is hiring or renting to or in any way tolerating an illegal alien. At the same time, there probably would have to be some kind of government program to make it easy for them to self-deport. When Japan wanted to get rid of their illegals, it was very similar. You know, back in the early part of the 2000s, they had, I don't know how many, but a lot of so-called guest workers over there. The economy crashed. They didn't need them anymore. And so the Japanese government went to these people and says, oh, thank you very much for your assistance. It is time for you to go home now. We will give you 1 year's salary and a free airline ticket and moving expenses to go back to Peru or Philippines or wherever. And in a country that small and centralized, where there was the political will to do so, it worked. And so it can be done, again, assuming the political will was there. In a country this size, though, the problem is that realistically speaking, the political will not exist with the system we've got. Both parties are utterly corrupted. Normal people have no more access to power, never mind military capability.
Well, let me ask you another question then, because I believe that 80-90% of the American people do not want the illegals here. They don't want them here. We have 92 million of our own unemployed.
Most of the blacks don't want them here.
If the EBT card collapses, those jobs that the illegals are holding are going to become much more valuable to everyone who's currently on dole. So what can we, as a people, do directly, direct intervention to two parties, those who hire them and to the illegals themselves, to let them know we are displeased with their activities. We're displeased that you're hiring illegals and not whites or not Americans. And we're displeased, tell the illegals themselves, we don't want you here. Go home.
Well, we're probably walking a line here, and I'm sure in various cubicles of the FBI office, I know my podcast is listened to in this one. Let me just put it to you this way, Mike. At some point in time, white Americans are going to have to decide collectively as a nation that we have had enough and that we are no longer afraid of the United States government and its armed men. We are no longer afraid of the militarized police and the black body armor. We are no longer afraid of the FBI flipping their badges on our doorstep. We are no longer afraid of their prisons and their jumpsuits. We are no longer afraid, period, and we are not going to let these people take our country and our lives away from us. Beyond that, it probably would not be politic for me to get too specific other than to say once again that our founding fathers gave us the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, not so we could hunt turkeys at Thanksgiving, not so that we could fight Indians, but so that we could, if necessary, turn those weapons on a government that has become a tyranny. A lot of people tend to forget that that whole thing at Lexington and Concord in 1775 was a gun raid gone wrong. The British were marching on the Minutemen at Lexington and Concord in an attempt to seize powder and muskets and musket balls and disarm them. That's how our revolution started. And beyond that, I probably should shut up.
Well, I mean, all right, let me ask you the hypothetical question is, if you had to guess, do you think that our government is actually going to go get to the point of door-to-door raids to disarm the American population?
They don't have the capability for it. Okay, first off, I am not really worried about gun control right now too much because, in a sense, that ship has already sailed. The official figure is there's supposed to be 300 million guns in private hands in this country. I think it's a lot more than that. I simply don't think it's practical for the United States government to seize all weapons. Now, what they might attempt to do is to pass some kind of overriding federal law that overrides and circumvents all state laws. That's one problem with gun control from their point of view is that there are over 20,000 state and local gun control laws in this country, and they vary from state to state, so forth and so on. They could do this in the name of, well, we've got to get all this uniform, you see. We've got to really start assessing the gun problem. The next step would be not confiscation, in my mind. It would be a nationwide registration program, and that would be the thin edge of the wedge there, because it would become some kind of 5-year prison felony to own or be in possession of an unregistered firearm. And of course, you know, registration is always the first step to confiscation without exception. Look at Australia, look at Britain, and so forth and so on.
Let me add the next step too, because once you have registration, you have confiscation. After confiscation, you have genocide.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens.
I think things would be a lot worse right now. I think things would be a lot worse right now than they are even if those 300 million guns had not been in private hands over the past few years. I think probably the presence of those 300 million firearms in private hands is what's been keeping the Obama regime, certainly possibly the Bush and Clinton regimes before it, it's what's been keeping the Democrats from just absolutely going berserk and imposing, just opening the border wide and just rounding up any, passing hate crime laws that, you know, arrest people like me and you for thought crime and that sort of stuff. The reason that they have hesitated as long, and they've taken their agenda as slowly as they have for all these years, is because they don't want to risk some kind of incident, some kind of explosion that would cause white America to finally throw the damn voting machines and voting booths to one side and start taking those guns out of the closet. I think they understand the possibility that that might happen, and they are consciously pacing themselves to avoid it. Beyond that, I don't know. And then again, you never really know what goes on in the minds of these people that are running things. And the process, of course, is a lot more complex than we, I think, can understand. We say, well, they're going to do this and they're going to do that. I honestly do not believe that there is any one big, huge controlling mind or conspiracy behind this. As I've said before, I think it is a conspiracy of consensus. It is a conspiracy of ideology, of belief that the white race is evil and must be destroyed. But as far as anyone's secret anti-white, anti-Christ hiding behind the scenes and doing this, I don't think that's the case. We're dealing with a trend, not with a so much of a big conspiracy. Yeah.
You hear the music? It's time for our bottom of the hour break. We'll be right back in a few minutes. More with Harold Covington. Stick with us, folks.
Okay, remember that song I played last week that sounded like it was off a karaoke track? Now, at the same time, this individual sent me about half a dozen more such numbers. Now, who performs them, I don't know, or maybe he told me this week and I'm getting so damn senile I forgot, but this one is interesting. This doesn't just seem to be a karaoke track. It sounds more like one of our guys is actually playing the guitar and doing an Elvis imitation, which is a little bit different. And this one's called Elvis Jungle Bunny.
where our nation's capital was once a beautiful city. Proud and fair.
Proud and fair.
Now it's 99% niggers, half a slum, and they had this nigger mayor.
Well, his name was Marion Barry, but he had to be sacked. Cause they caught him on videotape, the mayor of D.C. smoking crack. Smoking crack. Oh, you can take the bunny out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the jungle bunny. Jungle bunny. You can put a monkey in a monkey suit, call him the mayor, it'll just be funny. Cause you can take the bunny out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the jungle bunny.
Jungle bunny. Just look at O.J. Simpson, a millionaire, leading a life of luxury. We had everything a civilized man could want, still succumb to savagery.
Savagery.
Just like a bloodthirsty Zulu in Africa,
he slit their throats.
Ah! All the niggers in America loved it, cause he got away with the murdering white folks.
Murdering the white. You can take the bunny out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the jungle bunny. The jungle bunny.
You can put a monkey in a monkey suit, call him mayor, just be funny.
Ha! Funny. Cause you can take the bunny out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the jungle bunny. The jungle bunny.
Just look at Mike Tyson, a dominant silverback gorilla.
One to fear. One to fear.
Hell, he even bit off another nigger boxer's ear. What do you gotta do to get kicked out of boxing? Give him millions and he still rapes Miss Nigger America. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Black America. And goes to jail. They'll always revert to their savage jungle ways without fail. Without fail. You can take the bunny out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the jungle bunny.
Yeah, jungle bunny. You can put a monkey in a monkey suit, call him mayor, just be funny.
Or he can represent Prince Renegar.
But you can take the bunny out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the jungle bunny.
Oh, the jungle bunny.
Cause you can take the bunny out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the jungle bunny.
Jungle bunny.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss a coffee table book by Susan Bartoletti, and this is a book that deals with the history of the Hitler Youth, and it tells this history by giving vignettes of various HJ and BDM individuals. And of course, being a mainstream book, this goes into both the loyal and oppositional youth. Now, the first story that it goes into is the very famous story of Herbert Norkus. And this was made into a very well-known propaganda film that I'm sure a lot of us have seen. It was even on YouTube for a time. And that film was, of course, entitled The Hitler Jungquet. Now, it also talks about how some of these young people had to defy their parents in order to go to meetings, and gives the example of Milada Mashman and Elsabeth Vetter. This Milada later on becomes an author, and she writes a book that is an apologetic about her time in the BDM, and she calls it Account Rendered. But you have to understand that this book was written after she underwent denazification. So she, like a lot of other authors, recalling their time in the HJ and the BDM, is going to be dealing with some guilt issues. Now, evidently, as a mercy, and I've never heard of this group, but apparently there was even a group for German youth who were physically infirm. And I tried to find out more about this section of the HJ, and I really couldn't find very much about it. But, of course, for the most part, typically the HJ and the BDM had a tendency to emphasize sports, and this was particularly in the early days, around the time of the 1936 Olympics. The book talks a little about those Olympics and also other things that were happening in Germany around that time, just in order to give you a flavor of the era. And because it's a mainstream book, of course, it goes into the oppositional youth. Now, as far as the loyal HJ and BDM, more and more, and I mean, I suppose particularly the HJ, got very involved in various types of work. For example, at one point they wanted to create more farmland within Germany. Now, over time, the training, especially of the HJ, became more and more rigorous, and eventually they actually developed an SS-HJ unit that was under the command of General Franz Witt, and they were sent pretty much wherever the action was. And this group was activated about a week before the Allied invasion of Normandy. Not only were they in France, some cases they were even in the East, in Hungary and Prussia. Now, it gives profiles of an SS member who'd been in the Hitler Youth by the name of Emil Dürr, who really sacrifices himself selflessly in battle. And then also you learn about Alfons Heck, who was at one point in command of more than 800 HJ. Now, eventually, at the end of the war, the Hitler Youth were ordered to get involved in organizing the Volkssturm. And this was actually difficult for them because they found that a lot of the individuals were over age and at that point less than enthusiastic. Now, of course, at this point, you had some of the HJ getting involved in whole werewolf sort of saboteur methods and various groups that had to end up surrendering. And then, of course, the story of the psychological propaganda using various films and so forth. And, of course, various individuals having to go through various programs, as I've mentioned before. Now, this book does go into the fact that it was decided that, at least in West Germany, the Allies wanted to restore democracy so that that's sort of the way that democracy, I suppose you could say, or as Harold says, prevents change. They wanted to return a kind of a normalcy, a kind of Americanization, Westernization to Germany. They did that fairly quickly, encouraging Germans to be critical of their government, so long as that criticism, of course, was in legal bounds. It is true that in many respects, or in many cases, East Germany today is considered really a hotbed of what's often termed the radical right. So perhaps that assessment, that psychological assessment was correct in terms of bringing the temptations of what might be termed Americanization to Germans after they, of course, completed the denazification program. Now, a lot of the youth that are mentioned in this book, they did survive the war, and a lot of them actually moved to the States. A lot of the individuals profiled in here really sold out. And, of course, I always admire those that didn't, and those stories we don't see in this book. Nevertheless, I mean, if you did want a coffee table book that gives you an overview on the Hitler Youth that has very nice photographs, then this book is a possibility, but it is, as I said, it's a coffee table book, which means that it's rather large, and it is a hardcover, so you have to have the room for it in your collection. So you can decide if you would want this book in a collection. So have a good evening. Thank you for listening, and hail victory.
Greetings, comrades. This is Trucker coming at you from on the road. For those of you that are getting ready to make your pilgrimage, please be careful of your route. If you go to 11 foot 8, that's foot spelled out, .com, you can see what not to do. I'm assuming it's in the Chicago area. It's an 11 foot 8 overpass, well marked, and you'll get to see a whole lot of moving trucks slamming into it. And there's other areas besides that as well. So please check your route. If you're getting a larger truck, you may want to stop at a truck stop ahead of time and pick up a trucker's road atlas that will give you the truck friendly or preferred routes. And a lot of times it'll give you low clearances. So please make sure of the height of your truck that you're renting or driving across the country, because it ain't your grandfather's Pinto. Yeah, okay, I'm dating myself. I remember Pintos. Even driven a few. But anyway, that, and make sure of your GPS doesn't take you on any stupid routing that would put you on a crappy route. I apologize. I had a phone call come in there, as well as making sure of your route. Also, be advised that if you're driving a moving truck, and it may be a big truck, but it's also a big sail, so watch out for crosswinds, because the winds get strong enough, it can tip the rig over. Seeing that, I mean, semis get tipped over all the time due to high wind. Also, watch your speed on the corners, because they'll end up having a higher center of gravity than you're used to in your little Prius or whatever you drive. So just slow it down and take it easy around the corners, because we want to get you safely to the end. No injuries, no casualties, please. All right, well, this is a trucker signing off, bringing another episode in the future. Take it easy, travel safe. Hope to see you in the homeland soon there, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from out on the road. And in light of the been happening down in Missouri, wondering why you guys haven't migrated to the homeland. I mean, this is just totally nuts that you guys insist on staying where you are, listening to all the Jungle Bunny, Nigger Bunny music and stuff. It's just totally ridiculous. I grew up in the 60s, about an hour north of Detroit, and I am so glad to be out of that neck of the woods and out in the homeland where we are currently resided, not too far from Mr. Covington. It's a really nice area. I mean, yeah, there are bad areas Seattle and Tacoma and stuff, but for the most part, that's just the big metropolitan areas. If you stay out in the sticks, where we should be at and stuff, and the smaller communities, things are a lot quieter, a lot safer. Don't have to worry so much about shootings and the gang stuff and home break-ins, although, everywhere has occasional that kind of thing going on. The drugs are a lot less prevalent. The gang activities a lot less prevalent. It's just a lot nicer area. I mean, granted, yes, I have been up there since 1980, between the Puget Sound area and down by Coos Bay for a couple of years when I was in the Navy. Yeah, we've had our house up here since 1988, and wife likes it. She grew up the majority of her life up here in this area, and she really likes it up here, so here we have stayed. Travel all around the country in the truck and stuff, and it's one of those, I'm so glad when we cross the Cascades, better yet, even the Rockies, just getting back into the homeland and stuff, stress level goes way down, and just a lot happier. So why are you waiting? It's fairly nice this time of year for travel, so get your U-Haul loaded up and get headed out this way, because it's a lot better time to travel than when the snow's flying and stuff, and that'll be happening in a few months, and you don't want to have to put up with that. Okay, this is a trucker, signing off for another edition. We'll catch you again.
Okay, this is Steve from Michigan talking about his recent scouting trip here to the Northwest homeland.
My wife and I made our scouting trip in July, and I thought I'd give you some idea of what to expect. Prior to doing this, I had face-to-face meetings with some others in my area. I found that the individuals I met were generally like me. They weren't scary at all. Note to self, don't believe the portrayal of white supremacists that you see in media. Most folks are just happy to talk to someone else who believes the way they do about race and the current state of things in this country. No, you don't know for sure that the other person isn't an enemy who's trying to ensnare you, but as long as you don't discuss doing illegal things, you're safe. If they mention something about doing something illegal, just remind them that what they say is not safe. Okay, back to my trip. First of all, my wife is not racially conscious. Having said this, she does agree that sometime soon we'll need to go somewhere safer. My daughter and grandchildren don't understand that because my wife and I live on 14 acres, 5 miles from the closest gas station and 20 to 30 minutes from the larger cities. But if the only way I can convince her to take the gap is through white flight, I'll take it. We first went east for a couple of days to visit her cousin and family because her cousin's husband is dying. We then headed west. I wanted to make the entire trip as relaxing and enjoyable for her as I could. We got across the country to Colorado, then up through Wyoming and into Montana. We stopped in Montana, and I had a short meeting with a comrade there. Just another normal guy who believes as we do. We went from there up to Glacier National Park. This has been a favorite of my wife's, and she was saying how she could see us being safe if we moved to the western Montana area. We then went on to Idaho and stopped in Coeur d'Alene. On the pretense of a scenic drive, I tried to find approximately where the Hayden Lake compound was. I know I passed the road leading into it, but since it's no longer marked, I couldn't be sure. My wife enjoyed the scenery. We had a pleasant day. That evening, we were sitting in the Denny's, and I drew her attention to the fact that everyone, within sight, was ethnically like us. She did agree that white is an appealing color. We then went on to the Tri-City areas of Washington. On the evening we arrived, we went out to eat with Mr. Donner. I was somewhat surprised because she told me all along that she was not interested in meeting any of my friends. She was a little surprised that open carry was more prevalent in the West, but was not put off by it. We had a pleasant meal and conversation, and she was favorably impressed with Andy. The next day, I went to meet with Mr. Covington and some others. We chatted about some of our experiences and the current state of things in the country. There was a couple there with children. They were well-behaved and really helped to draw my mind to the second part of the 14 words. They must be protected. They are our future if we were to have one. I'm retired, and lately most of my sustenance has been Social Security. I don't mind trying to get back at least what they stole from me over the years. Since I don't require a job when I go home, my major concern was finding a location that my wife would come to. I will say, though, that I had determined to go home even if she wouldn't. At this point, we're trying to determine what sort of place we need when we get there. She foresees us having to have a place for our daughter and family and possibly some friends to come to when they flee the coming social breakdown. To sum it up, the trip was relaxing and instructive time for us. The negatives? We came in the summertime because I was impatient to get there and meet some of our comrades. If I were to do it differently, I would come some other time than when everybody else is on vacation. We had our dog with us, and finding animal-friendly rooms at a reasonable cost was daunting at times. I would not have included a side trip east that took us 1,000 miles out of our way at the same time, either. The positives? My wife and I love the West. Her comment about coming down Snoqualmie Pass west toward Seattle was that it reminded her of the Alps. It was so beautiful. Personally, I love the lower humidity. I did meet some of the wonderful people who are waiting there for us and I hope to work with. These are really just regular folks who have the same desire many of you do. Country of our own where we can raise our children in security and peace. Hail victory, comrades.
This is Mike Cross.
The Musicology Department at UNC Wilmington is proud to present this evening's lecture in musicology. Tonight's lecture deals with the Appalachian fiddle. Many people wonder how the Appalachian fiddle creates its unique sound and thus sounds so different from the violin. It does so because of the way in which it is constructed, which is in the following manner. We take an ordinary cigar box. We attach a series of laminated popsicle sticks. This creates the sound chamber and the neck of the fiddle, as it's now called. Now, the handsome scroll work up here is actually a cryogenically frozen Tennessee land snail, you understand? Now, taking the entrails of a mature feline, that is, cat gut, we stretch them across the sound chamber. These are the strings. Now, taking an ordinary cherry wood stick, we stretch hair from the tail of a horse, freshly washed, across the stick. We sprinkle it heavily with pine rosin, that is, sap from the pine trees indigenous to the Appalachian region. Finally, and most importantly, inside the sound chamber, we place a live baby kitten. Now, as the horsehair is drawn across the cat gut, two things occur. First of all, the baby kitten hears mother's entrails vibrating. That shakes it up. Secondly, the rosin dust from the bow flakes down into the sound chamber and irritates the kitten's nostrils. This causes the kitten to shriek aloud and thus produces the sound of the Appalachian fiddle.
Take that lady by the wheel. Lead her out in a great wide world. Take that lady by the toe. Take that lady by the toe. See just how far you can go. Woo! Swing that gun, I ain't foolin'. Come to love, I don't need no school.
Okay, last week I promised you another installment of our Who Guards the Guardians series here on Radio Free Northwest, so here goes nothing. Now, you know, during this series, I've been really ragging on our friends of the silk suits from the FBI, but they're not the only wing of federal law enforcement that's composed of stumblebum incompetence and drunken, sex-crazed thugs. Now, this week, the spotlight is on the boys and girls of the United States Secret Service. Come on down!
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Read every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number and taken away your name.
The United States Secret Service was founded during the Civil War by the famous detective Alan Pinkerton, who was in fact famous because he was so good at self-promotion. Pinkerton spent the Civil War filling Abraham Lincoln's head with all kinds of paranoid and non-existent Confederate spies and plots against him in order to keep those federal tax dollars flowing into his pockets. Now, even in those days, federal law enforcement was always about getting the budget. Pinkerton would have made a great modern-day federal bureaucrat. Of course, in April of 1865, when a real Confederate plot was hatched by John Wilkes Booth and his fellow conspirators, which successfully did take out old Honest Abe, Pinkerton's Secret Service was nowhere to be found. Lincoln's bodyguard that night at Ford's Theater was a certain Union Army Major Rathbone, who was an alcoholic and who was in the theater bar soaking up the whiskey when Booth snuck into the unguarded theater box and shot Lincoln in the back of the head. Now, for a long time, the Secret Service spent their time chasing counterfeiters, which is something they still do to this day. I don't know how successful they are at catching counterfeiters, although since they don't have the authority to arrest the chairman of the Federal Reserve, probably not so much. But in 1901, the Secret Service was given the task of protecting the president after the third presidential assassination in under 40 years, when a Polish anarchist named Leon Czolgosz plugged William McKinley in Buffalo. During the ensuing 113 years, they've lost one more president, although, to be fair, that was possibly to another government agency, depending on whether you believe the mob or the CIA whacked JFK. They've had one president wounded, again, possibly to another federal agency, depending on what you believe was really going on in John Hinckley's head. And in 1950, they've had one full-on shootout in the Blair House against some Puerto Ricans who were trying to take out Truman, whose life they duly saved. In February of 1933, an Italian named Giuseppe Zangara opened fire in Miami on the car containing Franklin Roosevelt and Chicago Mayor Anton Chermak. He missed Roosevelt completely, but blew Chermak away. Now, there's always been speculation that Zangara was, in fact, a mob hitman sent by Chicago outfit leader Frank Nitti specifically to kill Chermak and not Roosevelt, in which case the attempt was a success. In any case, the Secret Service was pretty much useless. Zangara's gun was grabbed, and he was wrestled to the ground by members of the crowd. You know, as an aside, there doesn't seem to be much doubt that Charles Guiteau, the guy who shot President Garfield in the Washington, D.C. railroad station, was a good old American nut job of the type who hears voices and plays with guns, a character as American as apple pie. Leon Czolgosz appears to have been a sincere proto-red who wanted to take down the number one capitalist. Plus, the PRs who attacked the Blair House were pretty typical left-wing Castro wannabe types. But again, depending on whose history and whose conspiracy theories you believe, it is possible that 4 out of the 8 assassinations and major assassination attempts, among which I count Bobby Kennedy as one, originated from within the United States government itself as attempted or successful coup d'états. In a way, I suppose it isn't completely fair to hold the Secret Service totally responsible for any fuck-ups, because anyone who really wants to get the president and honestly doesn't care what happens to himself has a pretty good chance of doing so. Now, there was an example of this on December 14, 2008, when Jug Ears Bush was foolish enough to visit Baghdad and walk right into a whole nation of people who wanted him dead. He was doing a press conference when an Iraqi journalist shouted, "Here's a farewell kiss from the Iraqi people, you dog," and threw a shoe at him, which in Muslim countries is apparently a tremendous insult. Now, if that shoe had been a grenade or a bomb, it would have been bye-bye Jug Ears. The Secret Service has always had the same kind of button-down, silk-suited image that the FBI cultivates. But like all other federal law enforcement agencies, political correctness and affirmative action and diversity have degraded their moral fiber and compromised their effectiveness as well. Now, to be fair, most of the corruption and drunkenness and bad behavior does seem to be a fairly new phenomenon with them, coinciding with the advent of total political correctness in the form of the Obamas and some new female director they've got, who apparently has a lot of years of man-hatred to work through and can now get a revenge on all the male agents she feels humiliated and disrespected her. Or else the Secret Service was always a lot more successful in covering up their escapades than the FBI has been. According to a USA Today article from last year, between the years 2004 and 2013, 824 agents were cited for various disciplinary infractions involving laziness, incompetence, dishonesty, alcohol and drug abuse, watching porn on government computers, which seems to be kind of the national government employee pastime. There's no details on whether female Secret Service agents send nude photos of themselves to their fellow agents with the same frequency as do their sisters in the FBI. Now, in March of this year, the Secret Service sent three agents home from the Netherlands for showing up to work drunk after a night of binge drinking in their hotel. Now, one of the agents was found passed out in a hotel hallway in the morning. The agents who are being investigated for what happened in Amsterdam were part of the counter-assault team, whatever that is. Now, in November 2013, a Secret Service supervisory agent named Ignacio Zamora, ay caramba, was discovered at the Hay Adams Hotel in Washington, D.C., trying to get back into the room of a woman he had met in the hotel bar after leaving a bullet from his weapon in her room. Now, what the hell kind of sex game were those two playing? When the woman refused to let Zamora re-enter the room, he called hotel staff, and he demanded that they let him in, and apparently he was in such a wild and hysterical state that the manager called the White House. Zamora and Agent Timothy Barraclough, who were both assigned to President Obama's protective detail at the time, were also investigated for sending sexually suggestive emails to a female subordinate. In April of 2012, an unknown number of off-duty Secret Service agents brought strippers and underage prostitutes from a club back to their hotel in Cartagena, Colombia, before a presidential visit to the summit of the Americas. Now, the incident blew up when some of the Secret Service men refused to pay the hookers, and the hookers called the Colombian cops on them. In August 2011, when Barry and Michelle were taking one of their six-week vacations in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, the Secret Service agents were put up at a private home rented with taxpayer dollars, of course, for their off-duty hours. And in the early morning hours of August the 18th, 2011, the Oak Bluffs Police Department was called to the property, which had become known to its neighbors as Animal House. They found the porch and the yard and the interior of the house littered with beer cans and alcohol bottles, and also with shouting and laughing Secret Service agents who were staggering around in various stages of undress and waving guns in the air, several of which appear to have been discharged in what sounds like backyard beer can plinking. No word on whether there were any underage prostitutes running around, Colombian or otherwise. According to an article in the UK Daily Mail, the Secret Service has developed a very bad reputation among the locals in Martha's Vineyard as boisterous, destructive, and aggressive drunks. No one wants to rent to them anymore for Obama's interminable vacations because they always leave the property in a shambles. According to a local restaurant owner interviewed by the Daily Mail, the female Secret Service agents are quote-unquote worse than the men when it comes to the partying. No clarification on exactly what he meant by that. In March of 2011, a number of Secret Service agents were pulled off Obama's protection detail in order to protect the director's personal assistant, a woman. She was having a dispute with her neighbor in a Maryland suburb. Now, this detail continued over the summer of 2011. No information on what it was all about. No information on how it was resolved or why the local police couldn't have handled it, rather than federal goons armed with machine guns. Interestingly, since the round-the-clock protection detail for the secretary lasted for some months, I get the impression the neighbor didn't intimidate very satisfactorily. Okay, look, I'm running long, so I may have to continue this account of the misdeeds of the Secret Service on some other occasion, but there's one Secret Service story I just have to tell. I need to preface this by saying that the Secret Service denies this ever happened, but it was reported at the time back in the 90s, and so it fits in with what we know about Bill and Hillary Clinton, and it fits in so well that I find it hard to believe there's not at least a little foundation in fact here. It seems that the Hildebeest was not quite so cool and calm and collected about the Monica Lewinsky affair as she let on. And about that time, one night in the White House residence in the East Wing, she went on a raging, screaming tirade against Bill, apparently not having to do much with sexual infidelity, or the knee pads, or the cigar, but because he was embarrassing her and ruining her chance for that New York Senate seat she was trying to carpet bag at the time as her first step to her own White House tour. Now, apparently, the sea hag got so bad with the screaming and the cursing that a Secret Service agent entered the presidential living room just in time to see Hillary hurl a lamp across the room at Bill. Now, being a loyal and highly trained agent, the Secret Service man jumped in front of the president and was struck by the flying lamp himself, full on. Now, evidently, the lamp cracked his head open and drew blood. The man had to have a number of stitches in his scalp. Now, as it happens, the United States Secret Service has a special decoration that's given to its agents who are wounded in the line of duty, either in apprehending counterfeiters or protecting the president. Now, I think the last time it was given was in 1981 to one agent who caught one of John Hinckley's stray bullets, but I might be wrong on that. It might even have been the Blair House back in 1950. Anyway, they now had an agent who had suffered a physical bleeding wound while protecting the president of the United States from an assault. Never mind the fact that it came from the president's wife. The fact was that this agent was now fully entitled to this special Medal of Valor for protecting him. And so after much hemming and hawing, the Secret Service agent with the lamp-cracked skull duly received his decoration. In absolute secrecy, with no public recognition or official acknowledgement to this day that any such incident ever occurred. Like I say, the Secret Service denies this happened, but what better confirmation can any event receive than to be denied by the most notoriously dishonest and deceitful regime in human history?
Secret.
Okay, let's see. We've had a comedy song and an old-time fiddle number on the program so far. What can I round off the show with? Irish, Scottish, medieval, lambeg drums. I know, I haven't played much for the Militaria types recently. Now, this is the favorite personal march of the Führer Adolf Hitler. In the Third Reich, it was played only when he was present. It's kind of like their version of Hail to the Chief. It's called the Badenweiler March. We'll be right back. Okay, running way long, so I'm going to sign off now with the briefest of closing homilies. Look, I won't get into what's brought this on, but I want to emphasize yet again a few points that I've made on several occasions over the past couple of months. Look, I understand that, movementally speaking, I am promoting a message right now that is deeply unpopular. I understand that you desperately, frantically do not want to hear what I have to say. I know that you really, really don't want to hear about packing moving vans and going through all the effort and aggravation of getting your ass up here where the hell you're supposed to be. I know that you really, really don't want to have to internalize the fact that basically we have pissed the last 50 years up against a wall, and now we have to start buckling down and doing what we should have been doing by 1974 at the latest, when Nixon went down and we knew the electoral process was no longer sacrosanct, which is building communities and infrastructure for the time that we should have seen coming back then and which we can most certainly see coming right now. I know that you are looking for quick and painless fixes. Of course you are. You're Americans. I'm pretty sure that at some point in time, probably fairly soon, somebody's going to come along with one of those quick fixes. Somebody who is probably David Duke Handsome without all the baggage and with a nice American flag pinned on his lapel. Or somebody else. I don't know how it'll happen, but I'm almost certain that before we can really get down to doing what we have to do, we're going to have to go through at least one more, how can I put this, national distraction. Some Pied Piper type who comes along tootling his flute and whatever his particular line is and trying to convince you people that there is some hope to bring back the good old days and return the old America into existence and basically lead you down the garden path like the Pied Piper. So look, I won't get into that now. That's a whole different subject for discussion. I will counsel you to resist this quick fix when he makes his appearance, as I suspect he will. But look, I will always tell you what you need to hear and not what you want to hear, even if you don't like it. Whether you appreciate it or not, the fact is, I'm the guy who always tells you the truth, and over the past many years, I've been right far more often than not. And we'll just leave it at that. I know you don't want to hear what I'm saying, but it is my duty to say it, and it's your duty to hear it. Anyway, enough on that depressing note. For now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha Andaban. Freedom.
Beating.